The following program is produced and furnished in conjunction with Mark Amtower of Amtower & Company, which is entirely responsible for its content.
This is Amtower Off-Center, sponsored by General Dynamics Information Technology. Every week, author, speaker, consultant Mark Amtower gives you his take on what's going on in the world of government contracting. Amtower Off-Center, with your host, Mark Amtower.
Welcome to Amtower Off-Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM, where it is now showtime with me, Mark Amtower, and Alan Shavatkin of the Professional Services Council. Alan, welcome to the show.
Mark, thank you very much for the opportunity.
Is this your first time on my show?
Been a long time since I've been here.
I thought you'd been here before. I know Soloway had been here several times when he was honcho there.
Who?
Some bearded dude. I don't know. So a lot of interesting things going on here, particularly around the realm of professional services. But before we get started, if there are people out there who don't know you or PSC, tell them who you are, what you do, and what PSC is.
Well, thanks for the opportunity. The Professional Services Council is a national trade association. We represent over 400 companies who sell technology and professional services to the federal government. We focus on acquisition policy, technology issues, and really the opportunity to engage with companies and between companies and the government. I'm the executive vice president and counsel for the association. I've been there a long time. My primary role is the policy issues that PSC engages in on behalf of our members.
And those are fairly broad because of the nature of the beast that we're talking about here.
Very much so. We span the spectrum from defense to civilian agencies, from the regulatory agencies to Capitol Hill. It's amazing how many opportunities we have to excel at the association.
There you go. And we'll talk about some of your recent. How often do you crank out these studies, by the way? It seems like about every 5 days something pops.
Well, we can be prolific at times, and it's important. We've been doing some of our studies. We'll talk a little bit about the acquisition policy survey that we released in June with our member partner, Grant Thornton. This is the eighth biennial survey that we've released, so we've been at that one for a while. We recently published a survey of CIOs and one on chief technology officers. The CTO study is our newest one, simply because we haven't had very many CTOs previously. Just last week, we released a paper that I hope we'll have a chance to talk about on transition to the new president. So when given the opportunity, we'll put that out. And these kinds of reports, they come periodically because they're taking off a lot of work. But we also write regularly on comments on regulations, and I'm sure that during the course of the conversation today, we'll have an opportunity to talk about some of those.
Oh, we'll talk about a few regulations, yes, indeed. So let's start. Not regulation, but a movement pushed by the outgoing OFPP administrator, Anne Rung, not the chief procurement officer of the country, because she has no certs. Did I say that out loud? But category management, it makes sense in a broad way for products, but how does it work with services?
Well, so it can certainly apply, but not as easily. I mean, there are certain services that the government buys as if they're commodities, and that may make some sense. So category management, we really need to talk about definitions, what it is and what we're trying to accomplish, or what the government is trying to, trying to accomplish. Certainly an analysis of the agency's spending as a look back is valuable. Where are they putting their resources? What are the kinds of procurements that they're making? And that can be valuable for services as well, if you look at that as categories of work. When you then try to manage that as a strategic sourcing, as a procurement technique, and as some of the OFPP memos, Anne Rung had issued three memos on category management, but they're really ways of strategic sourcing, limiting the access to certain types of procurements or for certain functions. That doesn't play quite as well for certain categories of services because while you're buying the same type, you're not buying the identical item over and over again. So it makes it a little bit more challenging. But the analysis can be valuable, and there's certainly across the whole spectrum of services individual activities that can be bought in the commodity manner and where category management would have perfect sense.
Well, yeah, but you know, the first thing that struck me about category management is skill level. So if you're buying similar types of professional services from disparate organizations, some offer a much, much higher level, and there's absolutely no reason to compare pricing when you get experience and expedited service with one and kind of a plotter with number two or category four, depending on your point of view.
Well, and that's exactly the challenge that we face, that the government faces and the industry faces in approaching this and in analyzing it. One service, engineering services are not the same from one to the other. But there are certain types of services that may very well lend themselves to at least the analysis of the spending and maybe to a procurement technique to facilitate the acquisition from a smaller number than everybody. And we see some of that coming up in many of the multiple award contracts where there are clearly requests and opportunities for task orders for services where having arrived at most of the description labor category and you get an understanding of what the requirements are, you can treat them all as almost commodities.
Okay. So overall, is this, I'm assuming that we're on a similar page here, that category management may not be the best approach for professional services?
It certainly, it wouldn't be my first place that I'd start. Again, separating out the spend analysis, probably helpful from the procurement techniques. If we agree on that, then I think we're on the same page.
Yeah, I mean, if it was a total LPTA world, which I have issues with anyway, maybe it would make sense, but I hate LPTA anyhow.
So do I. So let's not wish for that world on any of us.
Yeah, yeah. So I like subtle people, by the way. So. I don't understand them, but I like them. So leads into next question. Major issues facing professional services firms right now. I see a lot of activity going through vehicles like Oasis. So what are the surface issues and the subsurface issues that your members are facing?
Well, first of all, there's market issues. I mean, the federal government is spending less on services. We see the numbers, they're declining, and they have over the last couple of years. So there's fewer opportunities. Secondly, there's greater competition, in part as a result of that, but in part it's the nature of the technology and professional services industry. It's a very diversified industry. It's broadly segmented across government, so lots of competition. Those are two challenges on the industry side, looking at professional services. On the government side, buying services is very different than buying commodities. And so being able to describe the nature of the result that they'd like rather than just the inputs. So buying hours is not the best way to buy services, in my view, but it's the most common. Rather, we'd prefer that government try to buy outcomes, solutions, rather than hours, focus on the outputs rather than the inputs. That requires a different set of skills, both on the requirement side of what the agencies need, as well as on the contracting side of how to go by that. As more and more work is being acquired by the government in a quote, as a service model, rather than a buy-the-drink model or based on a demand model, it is going to require a different way to think about how to acquire services and the skills that are going to be needed in the government to be able to do that.
Okay. that could lead to our next topic, which we are going to pick up on the other side of the break. You're listening to AmTower Off-Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm here with Alan Shavatkin of the Professional Services Council. You can find the Professional Services Council at pscouncil.org. And over the next three segments, we'll be discussing several reports that they've issued. So you might want to go there and take a look at the reports. We will be back right after this. Welcome back to AmTower Off-Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm here with Alan Shavatkin of the Professional Services Council. So let's migrate from the issues facing contractors to perhaps some vehicles that they use. Are you seeing a rise in the use of GWACs and MACs for professional services?
Absolutely. And that's one of the challenges that companies face, and one of the challenges that agencies face, is this growth of the use of multiple award contracts. And GWACs, as you well know, Mark, are a subset of all these multiple award contracts. They're primarily in the IT space and require certain approvals from the Office of Management and Budget, which makes them a little different than the run-of-the-mill multiple award contracts. But that's clearly where the marketplace is going for agencies.
Okay, so and that would lead me to the I consider a very big news item, Oracle pulling out. Not, you know, 3 or 4 years ago they closed their own GSA schedule. So I believe their major partner is DLT Solutions. So solid partner, no big deal. Now they're pulling out of the schedules altogether. They don't want the VARs or DLT selling Oracle products through GSA. I have a few suspicions as to why, but I would like your opinions on this.
Well, I really can't speculate about I don't have any personal knowledge about Oracle's decision. I saw the news stories that were published about it as well. There's no question that the compliance responsibilities, the compliance burdens on companies who are selling through the GSA schedules are increasing. The compliance burdens on companies who are in the federal marketplace are increasing significantly. And so for some, I'm confident there's a constant evaluation of the risk-reward of the both the opportunity and the cost and subsequent business risk. So it is one of those challenges for companies as they look at the marketplace, not only about what they're offering into it, but how customers are buying. And this is where your question about the multiple award contracts starts coming in, because one of GSA's biggest competitors to the schedules is GSA, in my view.
Right.
So you look at it, the multiple award contracts that it's put in place, the OASIS contract, the human capital contract, HCATS, for
Alliant.
Others, the Alliant contract.
If we can get it done.
Sure. Just go right on down the list. So GSA is creating alternative vehicles for the schedules to allow customers to come in and buy in a different way. That's helpful because it creates more opportunity for agencies to buy. It certainly helps GSA because it puts more of their product up on the table. But I think it also provides a reasonable market opportunity for companies if they're able to get into the marketplace. So although we've had some concerns about some of these multiple award contracts, some of the qualification requirements for Alliant, for example, really restrict the marketplace of who can realistically compete because of some of the threshold requirements for eligibility for the vehicle. Sometimes there's a subtle or not so subtle shift. When Homeland Security announced that they were not going to issue a recompetition for one of its current vehicles called TABS, and they were going to then buy that off the GSA OASIS program, many of the current TABS holders and those who had planned to compete directly at Homeland Security for a standalone contract found themselves at risk of being out of the marketplace because they had no idea that Homeland Security was going to move work to OASIS, and so either they didn't compete or were not given a contract on OASIS. So I think those are some of the market challenges that we see here, and The other challenge, of course, is that agencies are still needing to find a way to fit their requirements into some of these multiple award vehicles. And I'll watch to see where the data comes, but I'm not going to be surprised if we also see a growth in the single award contracts again, back to the agencies issuing their own rather than using these pre-existing multiple award vehicles.
Which is what OFPP wanted to avoid.
Yes.
So the pendulum may swing back regardless.
It may swing back regardless. Agencies need to be sure that they can get the quality that they need from those vehicles, and there's still some work ahead. The vehicles have been set up as agencies are beginning to use them. We see some of the task orders now coming out under OASIS. Those are obviously a validation of the vehicle itself. And now let's look at performance and see if the agencies are going to get what they were asking for.
Well, I've also seen an uptick in the services being sold through NITAC vehicles, CIO SP3 and SP3 small. SUP is more a commodity, and CIO CS is more of a commodity. But I've seen growth in both of those as well. So there are alternatives out there. And there are two offices. There's FedSim, and there's the assisted acquisition at NITAC that help agencies set up those single award vehicles when necessary.
So there's where your experience is coming through and showing again. And that's exactly right. So that's what I said, even the case of FedSim and the assisted agencies, it's GSA being a competitor for its own vehicles by providing alternatives. We'll have to watch how all of this plays out, because as the dollars shrink, at least the spending is shrinking, the agencies may or may not be getting any less benefit from those dollars. Competition is certainly driving prices down. We see that. It'll be interesting to watch whether these multiple award vehicles can accommodate the diverse needs of the federal agencies.
Yeah. All right, we'll leave that one there. On the 29th, we finally got a continuing resolution, no budget, just a CR. But this triggered a number of actions that we were talking about between takes here. So what we have another CR. What leads up to this, and why do these just absolutely suck?
There's a technical term I hadn't heard in a couple of hours. The Constitution requires the Congress to enact the appropriations, and I think that says most of the rationale of why we have the challenge. There are lots of good ideas, lots of important issues for members of Congress to pursue. And the political process that Congress has to go through and does go through to enact these appropriations bills, everybody knows that you need an appropriation. I suspect that most members of Congress do not want to shut down the government, and certainly not at this period of time when the pre-election for Congress as well as the presidency. So that helps to energize members of Congress to make sure that their key issues get addressed. For Congress, and I was privileged to work in the Congress for 13 years in senior staff positions, there's no difference to them, for most members, between September 29th, September 30th, and October 1st. It's a last-minute deal is still a deal. Whereas in the executive branch, you've got a plan for a risk that the Congress would not execute that work. And so there's a lot of work that the agencies are directed to go through and have to go through to make sure that they're prepared just in case Congress fails to get their act together, or in an unusual circumstance if the president were to veto an appropriations bill. So that's what got us up to this precipice so far. And just to be clear, what the Congress enacted was a continuing resolution for all of the federal government, but they did adopt a regular appropriations bill, if I can use that term, for the Veterans Administration and its related agencies. So the VA is now covered for the balance of federal fiscal year 17, that starts tomorrow, the rest of the federal government on a continuing resolution, being able to spend only as much as they were able to spend last year, and that'll go through December 9th. So we ought to talk again in early December, because I think we'll have to revisit this issue again.
Well, if I was an outgoing procurement official, I'd spend my entire budget before September or December 9th.
Well, you can certainly plan. The laws won't allow you to actually spend that much money. But to the extent that you can put awards in place and accelerate your procurement activities, that's a good news story, and I think that's what agencies should be doing.
But, you know, I want to get back to the fact that OMB mandates that the agency heads have to plan for this. And this is something that's really well below the radar of normal news and just about anybody else that follows this stuff. How much time, effort, and actual expense is involved in that kind of planning? Because we're talking about every federal agency.
Yes, and there's certainly time and energy involved, and it's a displacement of work instead of financial people bringing a close to the books at the end of the federal fiscal year. They're forced to divert their time and energy to planning for a shutdown. The longstanding OMB directives, they need to prepare for it, even if the possibility is remote. And so about a week in advance of the end of a shutdown, the risk of a shutdown period, so a week before October 1st or a week before December 9th, if the Congress hasn't acted and the president hasn't signed a bill by then, they will be directed again to update their plans, make sure that they know who's essential personnel that'll have to come to work, what functions can continue because they have the funding that'll carry them through, and what functions would have to stop. It's an enormous amount of work across the executive branch. It has some impact on both the acquisition workforce as well as on the contractors who are then waiting to see those solicitations come up or the evaluations for award that may or may not get accomplished in that period of time.
So we're at end of FY, spend it or lose it, and you're told by your boss, oh, by the way, prepare for this other thing. And
and please do both.
Yeah,
please do both, because the calendar is going to flip. They cannot spend current year money, the end of the fiscal year money past today. And so, notwithstanding your challenge of updating your rules and devoting your time and attention to that, make sure that you execute the program that you have.
Yeah, 9:30 midnight, last time zone's your last shot, boys and girls. You're listening to AmTower Off-Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Alan and I will discuss some of the recently released PSC studies when we return after these messages. Welcome back to AmTower Off-Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I am Mark AmTower. I'm here with Alan Shavatkin of the Professional Services Council. Again, we're going to be discussing several of their recently issued reports. They crank out a lot of really good stuff, folks, so tune in, pscouncil.org. First one I want to talk about, Alan, is your 26th annual, and you put this out with my former friends at Grant Thornton. I say former because I used to know several of the people there. I don't know any of the key players there right now. I'll change that. But 26th annual federal CIO survey. What does this bring to the fore?
Well, what we were continuing to do, and we again did this in partnership with Grant Thornton, is to ask the CIOs essentially, what are your key issues, what are you facing, and how can both the government change and industry support what they're doing. There's no doubt the number one issue that the CIOs raised was the importance of modernizing the federal IT, their infrastructure, and the challenges that they face, both from a capability standpoint, not their own capabilities, but the capabilities to keep current to make sure that that infrastructure stays relevant going on into the next federal fiscal year and the next several years out, but also the resource challenges that they have. And so we explore those in that survey, pull those responses from them. And I think what it shows is that the agency CIOs are in a very difficult position. The recent laws have given them an enormous set of responsibilities. Sometimes those laws and regulations have given them a new set of tools, but it's less about the legal structure and so much more about the personality of who that CIO is and how they're viewed both within the agency and across their marketplace. So the CIO survey was an effort at trying to pull that out. We touched on the role of the CTO, Chief Technology Officer, as a component of the CIO, and also the Chief Security Officers, that those positions are now starting to be created because of the enormous risk and challenges on cybersecurity.
Okay. So how do these tie in to things we were talking about earlier, how CIOs acquire services? Are they using the GWACs? Did any of this shed light on Vitara, et cetera?
It did. I mean, the CIOs, the survey clearly says the CIOs welcome the strong endorsement that the Vitara legislation, Federal Information Technology Reform Act, gave them in terms of a statutory foundation for their work. It gave them a statutory seat at the table. And so they welcome that. But with that authority comes a set of additional challenges, resources being one. So the procurement side, while they again have responsibility for making sure that they own the what is procured, they don't have the control over how. And so they're still heavily dependent on the agency's procurement officials to be able to execute that work. And as I mentioned earlier in our acquisition policy survey, we saw some skills gaps in how the capabilities, both in generating requirements as well as doing the procurement by the procurement contracting workforce. So those seams and gaps come out clearly in our CIO survey.
Okay. Do you have any or do you want to have any speculation here on why commerce, under our buddy Steve, is the only agency that really has a significant passing grade? Both times grades have been issued, and what some of the issues might be for some of the other agencies. You don't have to touch on that if you don't want. I know it's a hot potato.
Yeah, well, it is. Steve's outstanding. Let me just congratulate Steve on his outstanding work.
Simone some laid of the some other groundwork there.
Yeah, no question about it. He's certainly an example that others can use. But each agency has a unique set of challenges and and burdens, and it's not a one-size-fits-all government. The function, while it's standard across government, individuals are not. There's no standard CIO function, a standard CIO individual performing those functions.
Okay. Do you want to touch on the CTO effectiveness report?
Sure. This is a great opportunity that we took advantage of. There is a growing trend to creating a role of a chief technology officer in federal agencies. Many agencies have them. There is no law that now gives them a statutory responsibility. So, again, it is how individual agencies have described that function. So, again, we wanted to survey the chief technology officers and others in the government to see how effective those offices are today and what are some of the opportunities for increasing their effectiveness in the future. I think what we found there is that a CTO has a critical function. We make a recommendation. It's that the CTO be part of the CIO office. It should not be a standalone. It should not be separated. And in fact, we go so far as to say that the federal chief technology officer, which is today formerly housed in the Office of Science and Technology Policy in OMB, be moved over under the chief, the federal CIO, Tony Scott's office in OMB. We saw that separation to be a difficult one to manage with the two separate work streams when, in fact, the CTO is really a part of, in our view, the overall role and responsibility of a CIO. So that we came with those recommendations. We'll be working with members of Congress who have are focusing on the role of the chief technology officer. And my guess is that there'll be some greater attention by Congress in the next Congress when it reconvenes after January to look at the role of chief technology officers in government. We hope our study will be a good foundation for that.
Okay. Now, we've also seen the emergence of CISOs over the last few years. Are there other areas that may pop up as well?
Well, I think we're coming pretty close to running out of functions for chiefs. We need a lot more workers.
And we need more Indians.
Maybe a few less chiefs.
There you go.
So we've not surveyed the CISO community directly, though we've had a lot of engagement with many of the people who are serving in those functions. I think, again, if the view is that the chief information officer includes both the technology side of that work as well as the security side of that work, it's my own personal view. It's not a PSC position yet, but I think I might have some ability to influence it, that CISO role should also be under the CIO. But that's a conversation we still need to have.
Okay. I noticed in the CTO study, and maybe you did it in the CIO survey as well, but you used a couple of former feds in here, Casey Coleman in particular. Is that something you normally do to have that experiential background there?
Very much so. And we were very pleased that both Casey Coleman at Unisys and Robin Leinberger at Deloitte were able to co-chair the study for us. We value their experience, their engagement, and the guidance on what are the right issues to be thinking about and what are the right actions to be taken. The recommendations are PSCs, and not necessarily of their two companies or any member of PSC, but we've always value that engagement, and we've used that model many, many times over the past couple of years to have senior industry officials, senior PSC member company officials take the lead on this kind of work.
Cool. All right, we're going to take a break. You're listening to AmTower Off-Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. We shall return after these messages. Welcome back to AmTower Off-Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Boy, if you could listen to the outtakes on this, you'd be maybe laughing, maybe crying, whatever. But we have two more studies to go through, and you're not going to know what we talked about in between anyway. So let's talk about fair pay and safety not being ready for prime time. That's my take anyhow. What's yours?
Well, this is an interesting set of regulatory requirements, Mark. And 2 years ago, President Obama issued an executive order called Fair Pay and Safe Workplaces. And I'm not aware of anybody who's against fair pay or safe workplaces. We're not at PSC. The challenges that we had with this executive order and with the rules, both in the proposed rule and even with the final rule, is that it goes into excruciating detail about how companies have to implement fair pay and safe workplaces set of requirements. Detailed reporting, reporting by contractors when the federal government already collects most of that data, a presumption of guilt until you prove yourself innocent, and other set of concerns, a lack of due process that really focused our attention all the way through the process. But the final rule came out on August 25th. And when we looked carefully at that rule, it was pretty obvious that there are many elements of preparation on the government side that they weren't ready to implement this rule when it goes into effect on October 25th. And so we sent a letter. In fact, we sent in two letters, one to the Federal Acquisition Regulation Council, the people who own the Federal Acquisition Regulations, and asked them to delay, and a second letter with a slightly different group of signers on that letter to the Secretary of Labor saying, okay, the rule's out, it's final, we'll try to understand it, but you ought to give companies now more than 60 days to prepare for this fairly rigorous kind of reporting and compliance responsibility. You might not be surprised to know that we have not yet received a response.
I'm shocked.
But I'm sure a favorable response is being prepared.
Are we being facetious?
I'm being a little facetious. I'm not expecting other than a polite. I do expect a response because the government officials are nice about that, but I'm not expecting a favorable response. The rule will go into effect on October 25th unless there's some intervening action. That intervening action, there are proposals in Congress right now that would delay or cancel out this implementation. Congress hasn't passed that yet. Obviously, the executive branch is opposed to that. The president has said so in messages to Congress. But we'll see as the end of this Congress winds out what happens on fair pay and what other actions companies or associations may take.
You know, I've had several conversations with people about this who know a hell of a lot more about it than I even want to. And none of it has been favorable. All of this is duplicative. The information is out there. Most of the reporting the companies have to do in other formats anyway. And you know, again, yeah, fair pay and fair wage. You know, yeah, everybody's in favor of this, but it just ain't right. I was going to choose other words, but probably get bleeped.
Well, it was our view, and we said so in our comments on the rules and in our public statements, that there were easier ways to accomplish the objectives that the White House, the president proposed in his executive order, and that came through in the regulations. And so, again, it wasn't that because we opposed the underlying principles, though the government should only do business with companies who are complying with the law. There was certainly a very onerous regulatory burden that this rule establishes. And it'll fall particularly on some of the smaller and mid-tier companies that may not have all the resources available to track the kinds of information that the government is asking them to do.
No, it's not going to be fun for the larger firms either. Doesn't make a hell of a lot of sense to me. So, final topic, or potentially the final topic here. PSC releases a transition report for the 45th president of the United States.
Well, we're going to have an election, and I'm confident
whether we
that
like
somebody
it or not.
Somebody will win. And so we've been working both internally with the PSC membership as well as with some of the other groups to talk about what are the things that matter to us as an association, to our members, as we look forward to the president taking office on January 20th. In the report that we issued 10 days ago or so, we highlighted four major areas that we thought were critical to success in the marketplace for the next administration. First of all, and we touched on this a little bit earlier, which is to harness technology and the new business models to modernize government service delivery. We're not buying the same items and services that we did even 5 years ago, and certainly not since 8, 9 years ago since we had the last transition over. So it's important that we take advantage of those new opportunities. We certainly need to improve government operations to better compete globally. I mean, we are in a global marketplace. We compete globally for talent. We compete globally for resources. and so we need to make sure that the government operations are as effective and as efficient as they can be. We've got some recommendations there. We need to build a, thirdly, we need to build a better engagement model to bring the best ideas from industry into government. There's got to be a partnership, much better partnership than we have today. This is not a hostile relationship. And while we can keep an arm's length relationship in the procurement process, that should not limit in any way the dialogue between government and industry looking for the best solutions. And the way to do that is through a different or certainly a better engagement model. And finally, a consistent theme throughout a lot of what we've been doing at PSC over the last couple of years has been to develop a government and industry workforces of the future. Usually we've talked about the importance of government workforce. We still highlight that. But the transitions are affecting industry as well. And so many of the advancements in the technology world are taking place in the industry. And if industry wants to be a better partner, we need to make sure that our workforce of the future is as capable as it can be, along with the government's ability to access that. And so we focus some of our attention in those four areas as well.
Okay. So I want to go to the better engagement model to bring the best ideas and solutions from industry into government for a minute. You know, DOD's opened an office in Silicon Valley. They want to expedite stuff. You know, to me, this opens a radically different can of worms. You bring companies into the government contracting arena, and all of a sudden they find themselves in that fair pay, safe workplace, and you know, DCAA audits, you know, all, and they're going, you didn't tell me about this part. Right. What's wrong here, Alan?
Well, you're absolutely right. And for many, these onerous compliance requirements are actually a significant barrier to entry. The companies tell us that all the time. And so what we see in the DIUX model at DOD, Homeland Security has also opened an office in Silicon Valley. Some of the agencies are using innovation labs and different techniques. I think what we've done is, rather than address head-on these onerous compliance responsibilities, what some of the agencies are doing is undercutting or circumventing the procurement process using other techniques. So my own view is that if we can streamline the acquisition system for some to encourage those non-traditional companies to come into the marketplace, then we ought to be able to streamline the acquisition process for everybody. No sense having two classes or categories of companies.
You mean a level playing field?
Yes, exactly right. But the playing field has got to be lower for everybody, to bring everybody up to the same level of compliance. And if we can accelerate the acquisition system for some, touting how fast some agencies are able to bring procurements together, well, if we can do that for some, we ought to be able to do that across the board. There's no reason that some less major procurements are taking 100 or 180 days to complete. We ought to be able to find a way to address that. That's part of that engagement model that we're talking about and bringing some of those ideas. I think one of the key recommendations we have is to focus on results, not on process and not on inputs. I mentioned this earlier about in buying services. Focus less on designing the opportunity. Focus more on what it is the government wants to get out of it. And then let the bright ideas in industry, whether they be from traditional or non-traditional companies, those who are geographically situated either in Washington or in Silicon Valley, come forward with the best ideas. So I think we can fix the procurement process to facilitate that. One of the foundations of that, I think, is just a better way of government and industry communication. We can encourage that to take place across a wide range of functions. I think the government will have a better idea of what industry is doing. Think about that as a market research tool. Should be better able to understand what's out there in the marketplace, how to buy it, how industry is selling it, and how to make that available to the government.
Final thoughts.
It's a big government. Services is dominating what the marketplace today. But the nature of the services that are being sold today are very different than they were 3 or 4 years ago. I think both government and industry need to increase the capabilities of their own workforces. We need to focus on increasing the capability of the procurement system to acquire the emerging nature of technology and professional services. And we need to address the compliance issues that are serving as a real disincentive to more companies coming into the marketplace.
Bingo. Thank you so much for coming in. Again, Alan is the EVP and counsel for the Professional Services Council. Find them at pscouncil.org and take a look at these reports. If you're a services company, large or small, they got room for you. This is not my day job. You are facing a new FY. It's here, boys and girls. If you need to review your marketing program, if you need to highlight your SMEs, your subject matter experts, develop thought leadership, or better leverage social media, particularly LinkedIn, give me a shout, mark@federaldirect.net. And thank you very much for listening to AmTower Off-Center.
You've been listening to AmTower Off-Center, sponsored by General Dynamics Information Technology. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. AmTower Off-Center, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.